Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Happy post-draft week.
Yeah, sure. Syracuse was shut out of the draft for the second time in 3 years. This coming on the heels of, what was it, like 35 straight years or something where we had a draft pick?
Yeah, and a couple of, like, big years in the late Marone years where we had, what, 2 or 3 years in a row with first-round picks?
Yeah, so simpler times.
Yeah, and I think a pretty big surprise. Obviously, last week I said I was pretty sure Ambedatau would go. He did not, even though it was a draft that pushed wide receivers to the front pretty quick. So, hopefully he can latch on in Jacksonville and work out, because obviously we'll all be rooting for him after the awesome year he had for us.
I completely agree. I think I was pretty convinced, especially going into the sixth round, there were only about four wide receivers. Not even four. I think there were three wide receivers maybe in front of him on like the big board. And figured, you know, a guy like him, record setting, obviously a little raw, but had a ton of potential. Seemed like a shoe-in to go. That didn't happen. But nonetheless, I think him catching on with Jacksonville might end up being for the best. I know guys talk about this all the time of like, once you get into the seventh round, you're kind of praying you don't get drafted, because then you end up being able to pick the best spot for you. You potentially have more financial upside that way. And obviously for Amba, he gets the safety net of being able to walk into a very Syracuse-centric and Syracuse-friendly situation with Doug Marone and Tom Coughlin. While neither of them recruited him or coached him in any way before this, I'm sure that he'll get a pretty good shake down in Jacksonville, maybe better potentially than some other undrafted prospect would have gotten. So I very much expect to see him on Sundays now that he's down with the Jaguars. I know Brizzly's team ended up with the Jets. I think that's another good fit for him. I don't have the special teams numbers in front of me, but I would assume the Jets have been very bad on special teams.
Yeah, I mean, with both those teams, you have very unsettled situations. The Jets have some receiver talent, but it's not like, you know, an overwhelming group. The Jets needed people all over the place, and obviously we talked last week about how Brizzly, if he could carve out a niche as a special teams, like a really good special teams player, there's always a chance that he'll latch on there. And with the Jaguars, I think Wayne Morgan got a shot with them too, I believe. Did I see that?
Yes, he ended up getting invited to their rookie mini camp. So a little less of a guarantee than what Amba has. Amba has the chance to work himself pretty quickly into the like main roster, while Wayne Morgan will have to go through the rookie mini camp, and then after that he'll then get invited to camp.
Yeah. So, I mean, like we said, you could always trust the Doug Marones and Tom Coughlins, and now that they're together, that group to at least give Syracuse people a shot. Even, you know, it doesn't guarantee anything. It doesn't mean they're going to make the roster for sure, or that they're going to get any significant playing time, but if you're a Syracuse player who is sniffing the NFL, you have a very, very friendly franchise in Jacksonville now, where you can at least, you know, possibly get your foot in the door. So good for those guys. Hopefully it works out. I think we'll all be following Amba, especially since he'll probably be one of those guys who has a chance to really impress in camp and then the preseason. We've seen receivers, you know, in recent years throughout the NFL really have huge preseasons, end up becoming like solid players. So that'd be a pretty cool thing. Unfortunately, he has to deal with Blake Bortles throwing him the ball, which is a whole another adventure.
Yes, Doug Marone is the most loyal idiot, and we thank him for his service to his alma mater long after he's gone. Who's Hard Knocks this year?
Or not? Tampa Bay, which should be interesting.
Tampa Bay. Have the Jags ever done it?
I don't know off the top of my head. It's actually kind of surprising if they haven't. But
I would assume interest is minimal.
Is that a very interesting team? And like, and you know, I don't think a Doug Marone, Tom Coughlin led Jags would be very interesting either. They're not. That's not really their whole thing.
Yeah, the Del Rio Jags would have been fun.
Yeah, potentially.
And
that was
to be
an
honest,
interesting group.
The first Coughlin Jags would have been fun too. There were some good personalities, and the team was really good. I mean, the Coughlin team with Brunell and Jimmy Smith and Keenan McCardell and Fred Taylor, James Stewart, all those guys. That team was fun as hell. And the '99 team. I still contend, was the best team in the league that year.
Yeah, this is definitely not the same group. You don't really have, aside from Jalen Ramsey, you don't really have those personalities. Like Leonard Fournette, this is who they have this year, is not like a huge flashy personality. He's an awesome player to watch on the field, at least at the college level. So, but Marone, I don't see, I mean, it's not always a team's choice. I don't think any team would like outwardly choose to go on Hard Knocks, but Marone would, I think, be one of the least amicable to the idea.
Yeah, I would definitely have to agree there. But yeah, Tampa Bay should be fun. I'm sure Jameis will say something stupid at some point to have himself in hot water yet again.
Yeah, Tampa's a definitely interesting one. You have Jameis who, you know, for all of his off-the-field stuff, like, even when he's not trying to get himself in trouble, can kind of do that, like with that speech he gave to that elementary school last year,
yeah,
which was just really silly. Just a dumb, like, especially if you're Jameis, you need to be looking out for stuff like that. Like, unforced errors like that are just not good. But he is, you know, for better or worse, a charismatic figure. And just a lot of interesting young players. And I liked what they did adding O.J. Howard, who, you know, people who only tune into the biggest college football games of the year will think is, like, one of the best players in the world. He didn't really have that long-term impact at Alabama, but he showed up in big spots. They didn't really seem to, like, try to use him that much, but super talented, and that he joins a really big, physical, athletic group of receivers in Tampa. So that should be an interesting team to watch, and you don't always get those teams that are projected to do big things on Hard Knocks, which makes it kind of an interesting thing this year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, last year, obviously, those who watched saw the Rams, and they were terrible, but they had potential to be maybe a 500 team. They were not. I think you're going to look at Tampa schedule allowing could be, you know, I think last year they won, what, 9 games? I think they could be in that range, 9-10 wins yet again, and that might be enough to get to the playoffs. I think this will be, like you said, one of the rare opportunities to get a glimpse of a playoff team in advance. We'll see. I could see them challenging for that division. This isn't to get like into an NFL talk here, but I could definitely see them challenging for that division, given some of the questions around Carolina. Obviously, in the last 2 years, Carolina's lost a bunch on the defensive end. Cam's still there, though. You know, drafting McCaffrey like we thought they would is obviously a big boon for that offense. I think they're going to be able to rebound on that side of the ball. Again, we'll see on the defense. I think New Orleans, this is kind of their last shot, but I don't think that defense has it either. And then Atlanta, we'll see what a Super Bowl hangover looks like. It obviously hasn't done teams favors in recent years. The loser of the Super Bowl in the last probably 10 to 15 years has oddly, I think, missed the playoffs like more often than not the following season, while that used to not be the case at all, probably from about beginning of the Super Bowl until about maybe 95 to 2000, and then since then it's the trend has gone completely the other way for teams that lose that game.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely an interesting trend, and obviously they've had some major shakeups on the coaching staff, especially the offensive side, where, you know, you would think they would just be able to retain the principles that they gained under Kyle Shanahan, who obviously put in some serious work last year as the offensive coordinator, but he's off in San Francisco now.
It's for the best.
for the best for him.
For the best for everybody, based on what he did in that fourth quarter.
Well, yeah, I don't want to totally disregard like the entire season for one bad quarter, but and it's, you know, clearly the defense didn't really do their job either, no. Doing up 25 points, but or more than 25 points, 25 to tie. But you know, there is a chance that I'm not even sure who has stepped in for him. Who's the new OC in Atlanta?
Let's find out. Awesome radio. Sark.
Oh, it is Sark. I totally forgot about that. So yeah, huge question mark.
This is gonna be a blast, man. Atlanta should get Hard Knocks again.
Oh God. Yeah, like does Sark, who even knows, he's going to be at the NFL level as an OC. Like, he's had mixed reviews as a play caller at the college level.
Perfect.
So
that's exactly what Atlanta needs right now.
Right, yeah, you know. So I remember thinking that was a weird hire as it was, because it's not like you were going to poach some, like, proven flawless offensive mind. Like, Sark has done a nice job at the college level at multiple spots, but it's not like he was like the most obvious guy to make the leap over to the NFL. So, yeah, that'll be an interesting group. Tampa Bay was very good last year and just happened to run into an Atlanta buzzsaw. Even Carolina, I thought, had a really nice draft and really helped out Cam Newton, getting some solid offensive playmakers. So I don't know if they'll make the jump all the way back to the Super Bowl or anything, but I think that they are a natural candidate for some positive regression to the mean. In this case, I guess it would be progression to, you know, being competitive again, because their fall off was so stark. So that should be a really interesting division overall.
Oh, and the Saints. The NFC South draft cast. Dan and I said before this podcast we were going to find a way to talk about unrelated shit for at least 10 minutes, and we already pulled it off in the initial 10 minutes. For those who haven't tuned out, this is a podcast about Syracuse sports. So now we will pivot a little bit, Dan, into a topic we were discussing earlier. Earlier in the week, I had a 5 predictions for the next 5 years of Syracuse football article. Kind of discussed 5 things I think could happen between now and 2021. Going down that list, and then we'll discuss some kind of offshoot conversations. Number one, I said Syracuse will make 4 bowl games in 5 years. Dan, do you think that's a possibility?
I think that's probably on the optimistic end of things. I would probably go with 3 if I had to guess, because we don't, you know, I think it's not necessarily a lot that Babers will be here in 5 years. I'm more likely leaving for a bigger job than getting fired, but and if he is here, there's always a chance that there's that 1 year where you have a lot of turnover, or you have, you know, one class just doesn't totally pan out and you end up having a down year. So I'd say 4 is definitely possible. I do think it's probably a bit on the optimistic side. But I do think 3 in the next 5 years, assuming the team keeps on progressing the way that we hope and believe that they will, is a very attainable goal.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, like, if the team decides to schedule better, then sure, super attainable. You know, I mean, after this season, they face North Carolina. And then I believe, does the rotation start over with the Coastal? Which means we'd face Duke, and like a Duke team that I'm not really sure what they are anymore.
We face... I'm not sure, because we haven't faced Miami yet. We faced Duke at the Dome that 1 year.
Right.
But obviously we haven't gone there yet.
That's everywhere.
I'm not sure... Is it... Because we've had the Georgia Tech nightmare that I want to scrub from my brain at some point in my life.
No, Georgia Tech's first. Okay, so Georgia Tech, then Duke.
Georgia Tech was the first one, yeah.
Yeah. So if it follows the exact schedule it did the first go around, it's Georgia Tech and then Duke.
And then yeah, and I'm not. Yeah. I have to look it up. I don't know if that it's doing the same exact rotation. It would make sense that it would.
There's no reason why it shouldn't, to be honest. But.
Yeah, it doesn't make. I mean, football schedules are stupid, but I assume that's how it will work if it goes that way. So, yeah. Scheduling, I think you had that they would complete their schedule. There's no reason they shouldn't be able to.
Like, tomorrow.
Well, yeah, but especially when you see other teams that are in no better position, like Purdue, which I feel like Purdue schedules a game every couple weeks. I guess Purdue probably gets a lot of phone calls. But like Purdue has a game scheduled in like 2029, 2030. I would imagine
that was announced.
Yeah. And not that I want to be scheduling TCU in the next couple of years, but I would imagine that there are some teams that would find it even Syracuse attractive and would like to get it on the books. And I can imagine that, you know, I would hope that Syracuse would start to make some moves so that we're not putting ourselves in holes. Obviously, this whole scheduling thing has been kind of a mystery since basically when Gross took over. It's never quite jived with how the rest of the country does it in terms of time frame. I do hope that with Wildhack in, and as he continues to make his presence felt at the athletic department, this is one of the things that changes. And obviously we have our preferences as to who you're playing and you know what kind of schedules we get. And I hope he's a little more amenable to those. Just getting things on the books going forward because of how fast this stuff works out is important, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I understand the lack of need to schedule an FCS team, like, several years out, but at the same time, like, other programs do it just fine. I've heard a lot of chatter now about Wildhack saying things about the schedule, about Babers saying things regarding the schedule. So, like, if we've been talking about this for a year now, like, or almost a year since Wildhack came in, like, cool. Now let's get something on the books. Like, I would, again, I'm not an athletic director. I don't know how long these conversations take, but if I had to guess, they don't really take a ton of time to float a date, float a financial figure for the series that need them, and then go for it. You know, for me, I think that the goal here is winning games, and there's a lot of teams that probably think they can beat Syracuse every year, and there's a lot of teams that Syracuse probably thinks they can beat. So, like, if SU, from now through 2030, like, SU should probably have called every Conference USA and Sunbelt team already, save the good ones. They should have probably called Kansas, even Rutgers, Purdue, Illinois maybe, a couple others, like, I would say with some frequency to try to get those on the books. I mean, the Wisconsin series was one of the most, like, scheduled out things they've done in recent years, and that one, which was decided on, like, 2 years ago, you know, doesn't make any sense for either team. Like, Wisconsin gets nothing out of going to New York, and we get nothing out of going to Wisconsin for the most part, other than a probable loss. The Army series was great, and I'm glad to see that. I wish SU would have just said, you know, we're with Army for the next 10 years and just signed on from there. I think that's mutually beneficial. I know that the outcome here is not going to be everything all of us want. But I hope it's at least some of the things, and I think Wildhack has indicated that he wants it to be some of those things. But like you said, and like I've reiterated in multiple articles over my tenure at the site, that the longer we let this sit here and wait, the longer we're going to end up getting screwed.
Yeah, you want lingering. And like you said, you know, ideally we aren't scheduling ourselves into holes by going out this far, and we're not, you know, oh, hey, we scheduled Alabama in 2032. Great. But I'd almost be more amenable to that than scheduling Alabama in 2019, because it's all we had to, it's all the only option we had. At least give me time to prepare for my funeral rather than, like, hitting me over the head with a shovel from behind.
It's a good analogy.
Sure. I guess.
But like, 2018, like, we're already, like, one of the only teams, if not the only ACC team already, that has an opening left, for, like, an FBS opening for 2018.
Yeah, and you're just not giving yourselves, you know, you're not putting yourself in a position, even this year. Like, Middle Tennessee, that's not the best team to be playing. Like, they're kind of dangerous. And now they happen to have our former head coach on staff, which I don't know that it means anything, but, like, I'd rather be playing a lower-level MAC team, for sure. So, even, like, the difference between those, like, bought win versus a, you know, let's say Middle Tennessee has a 30% chance of winning that game. Like, that's higher than you'd like.
Yeah, and, like, I said it when the game was scheduled. Like, I'm glad that the schedule was just done, but at the same time, the fact that we scheduled a team that runs a similar style to us and basically nullifies our advantage of speed, like, why would you do that? just why would you do that?
Dan and John complained about scheduling for the probably 75th time on this podcast.
We've been doing this for 4 years now. There is.
Oh, it's probably more than that. Then we've done it pretty. We've done it almost every week for 4 years. So we're probably. Who even knows what episode this is at this point? Probably done it around 100 times.
I'm gonna guess. Knowing that we probably have about, I'm going to say 48 to 50 episodes a year, we're probably nearing episode 200 with, like, me in charge, which is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, this train just chugs along.
Tulane, scheduling, beer, the three constants of this podcast. Only one of them has to do with Syracuse.
Well, I would contend that beer has a lot to do with Syracuse.
It does. And to be honest, so does Tulane. We should schedule them every year.
Except for apparently this year they're going to be kind of scrappy, according to, I think, Bill Conley at his Tulane. I don't know if his preview went up today or he was just hinting at it. I haven't read if it was up.
I think
it went
up a couple weeks ago, and like I just missed it, and I was going to tweet about it the other day. Like,
really? I thought his ace. I thought he was on the American now.
He's on it now, but he's like at the. He's on like the back end of the American. Like,
okay.
Tulane was like one of the first teams he did.
Okay, so he might have already put it up, but I saw a tweet like in the last little days. I've also been way out of it. I was at a wedding all weekend. I haven't even like gone through and looked at all the draft results. I watched the first round, and then I looked at what the Packers did. And I looked for the Syracuse guys, but who didn't get picked, obviously. But like, I am very behind on like general sports stuff outside of like the NBA playoff results and stuff. Because I was very off the grid for a couple days, and it was kind of great.
Look at you! I don't know how to do that.
It was the first time I've like was away from. I probably checked in on Twitter like maybe once a day for 5 days, and it was very refreshing. And today I dove back into work and everything, and I was like, ooh, this is a lot.
I can't do that. My wife hates it because I am not I'm not capable of like when I took off for most of that week earlier this year, when I was in Syracuse in New York, like I still wasn't completely off the grid because obviously I was in Syracuse, so I had to be sharing things that I was doing there.
Yeah,
but I don't know if I'll ever be able to, you know, like fix that.
Yeah, that's generally not my MO, but I had a wedding things to do the whole weekend, and I was with a bunch of people who didn't really care to talk about, you know, Syracuse sports, and I was on a beautiful island in South Carolina, so I just kind of just didn't look at Twitter, which was fine, but now I'm right back in. My brain vacation has ended, and here we are.
Moving on a little bit. Okay, we still have three more things on here, and then we can kind of maybe we'll get that to halftime. Then we can talk about the five things we might have thought 5 years ago. Carrier Dome renovations will have started. If they haven't, we're screwed, in my opinion.
Then they have to have started. Like they're, it would be such a dismal failure on everyone if the dome renovations are not at least like I wouldn't even know even past started. I think dome renovations should like.
We should
have a pretty good idea of like when they'll be finished too. Like, don't just do the whole thing where you break ground on like a little thing and then it's like, well, this isn't really even part of it. Like, dome renovation should be like an actual tangible thing that we like kind of have a good idea of the end date for and everything.
Yeah, I would agree there. I was just trying to be positive in this article.
I noticed.
Like, actively said so at the beginning. Like, trying to put everybody's best interest at heart. Syracuse gets another quarterback drafted. I think this one might be the most likely of all of them.
I think there are two ways to look at it. We've only had, I mean, was Nassib the only quarterback drafted since McNabb?
Yes. We've only had three drafted ever.
Okay, so you can look at that and say that makes it seem unlikely, but I would argue that really doesn't matter at all because the Syracuse program now is entirely different than the Syracuse program even 2 years ago. This is a whole new animal. That being said, I don't know that, you know, there's a penchant for teams to go against quote-unquote system quarterbacks, but a fair amount of those guys, like the Texas Tech guys, the guys who are playing these prolific offenses, do get picked at some point. Like, so I think we've talked about this in the last couple weeks. Yes. It wouldn't shock me if Eric Dungy was like a sixth or seventh round pick if he stays healthy for two more years and puts up big numbers. It doesn't mean he'll play. Ryan Nassib really hasn't played yet, and who knows what's going to happen with him.
Jaguars,
yeah, he's still a free agent. Yeah, come on.
Why hasn't Doug Marone called him yet?
You think I would assume they text all the time.
You think he's waiting like for like if Nassib gets a contract somewhere else, and then like if he doesn't, then he'll invite him?
It's possible. Especially with Bortles, I think they didn't. Bortles just sign something again. I've been like way off the grid, and Jaguars updates were not in the front of the mind for me. I think Bortles just re-upped. He re-upped some kind of tender, but I don't think it was anything super binding. So like, there's no reason why they couldn't bring in Nassib just to see.
That's the thing though, if you're Jacksonville, wouldn't you just tank and then knowing next year that like if you finally get the first pick in the draft, which you never have, that you'll get Sam Darnold?
It's not the worst idea to say they're building a pretty nice team outside of the quarterback. And even the quarterback, like, Bortles, the first, his first, his second year, whatever, the year before last, like, he didn't look terrible. He just didn't progress at all last year and arguably became worse. So, I mean, I think that they're a pretty interesting bunch. They have Fournette now, which I don't know that I love picking the fourth pick or using the fourth pick on, but he's there.
Fournette's an exception, I think.
Yeah, I think I would have taken him if I was in, like, the middle of the first round. I just don't love taking running backs that early, and there's a chance it works out. So, like, it wasn't, like, an awful pick. I thought it was maybe a tad early. But, you know, the year before, they got Jalen Ramsey, who is, you know, aside from Ezekiel Elliott and Dak Prescott, probably, I mean, he was easily one of the five best rookies in the league last year. Throwing, like, Joey Bosa, too, I guess. But he's a monster. They have some nice playmakers on offense. Fournette should give them... I can't imagine Fournette not being at least a good NFL running back. I don't know that he'll be great, but there's a chance he is. And I think his floor is probably pretty high if he stays healthy.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what their line construction looks like, which is important for him. But like the pieces are being moved into place there. Obviously, in the NFL, like you really can't win at a big level without decent quarterback play. But there's a chance that, like you said, if they were to just totally go in the tank, and they might not even have to bench Bortles for that. Like, he might just do it on his own. But getting a guy like Darnold or one of the other big quarterbacks to me in the next couple of years, like, that could be a really interesting team. And that's why I said I like Marone taking that job because, like, the Jaguars are kind of a joke franchise. Like, outside the Browns, there aren't many that are worse on a consistent basis. But
they're the 2009 Syracuse of the NFL.
That's not a bad way to look at it. They just have a lot of very interesting pieces that just aren't totally like glued together yet. So hopefully Marone is a guy who can make this work.
I agree. And y'all been watching JagsCast here on Channel 4. We're talking about the Jags. We come back from these messages. I'm sure I've already offended some Clemson fan.
Oh, God.
With that accent.
So many nasty emails.
So many nasty emails are coming. No, for all those reasons and the fact that C.J. Beathard is probably going to start an NFL game this year, I feel like it's pretty likely a Syracuse quarterback is getting picked sometime in the next five seasons.
Not only that, but they like really wanted him.
Yeah, like really, like third round wanted him, which is just stunning to me. There's a lot of quarterbacks that are probably going to see the field this year, which is weird because I feel like the same exact teams that are going to start these guys, save Houston, who I think Deshaun Watson's going to win that job before preseason even ends. I feel like most of those teams, so like San Francisco, Cleveland, a couple others, are going to be picking at the top of the draft again next year and are just going to end up picking a quarterback that's going to be infinitely better than the guy they picked this year.
It's possible, and that's why I don't mind. I never really mind taking a quarterback like past the third round.
Past the third round's fine. Before the third round, the guy better be good.
Yeah, because in the first three rounds, you have a guy that you either project to be a long-time starter or you think can play right away. Fourth round and on, like if you think a guy has a shot of being an NFL starter at any real level, like I think that's worth the gamble. So you have a guy like Josh Dobbs, who I am totally not bought in on at all, and I was shocked when he started like climbing the hype ranks earlier in this draft process. But if you're the Steelers in the fourth round, like why not?
I love him at that pick.
Yeah, because, I mean, let's say there's a 10% chance he turns, and that could be even high, because quarterbacks just are such a crapshoot, but if there's a 10-15% chance of him being your next starter after Roethlisberger, that's a great value. And if you blew a fourth-round pick, like, who cares?
Peterman with the Bills, too. Like, that was a great pick.
Yeah.
It was, like, fifth round. Like, absolutely. Like, absolutely give me Nate Peterman in the fifth round, like... I don't want him in the first three like rounds for by any means, but yeah, give me him as a fifth round pick, and he could potentially start this year too.
Yeah, so I'm all for taking gambles like that. I mean, that's kind of what Nassib was with the Giants. Like who even knows? He didn't really get an opportunity because Eli is probably the most dependable quarterback we have right now. But
has never missed a start since he got the starting job halfway through his first year.
Right.
Somehow.
So. Like that wasn't the best situation for him, but he was still a gamble, and I don't think Giants fans are like forsaking that draft pick at this point. He was a really solid backup who I think, you know, especially in that one preseason where he tore it up, like people were pretty positive about.
Yeah, and now we picked a guy who I'm worried about, but also optimistic about, because he'll have 2 to 3 years to actually turn himself into a pro-style quarterback.
Right.
I'm talking about Davis Webb, for those who did not follow the Giants draft as closely as I did.
Yeah, and he was a die. It seemed like there was a 7 or 8 quarterbacks that like someone liked for, as a potential late first rounder. He was one of them. Dobbs was one of them. So, I mean, if you can get a die, if you like a die that more, and even for the 49ers, like, I don't see C.J. Beathard being a great quarterback, but clearly Shanahan does. So why not take a shot in the second or third day?
Yeah. Worst case, you're picking in the top 5 again next year, and you'll have your pick of actual quarterbacks who are probably going to be franchise players.
Yeah, and best case you get, or medium case, I guess, you get Kirk Cousins, which
cool
is something.
Anyway, last thing before we get to halftime. Someone wears 44. I think it happens. Dan, do you?
I have no idea.
Nobody's mentioned 44 in about, like, 18 months.
That's the thing, is Babers is such, like, he's just not a Syracuse traditionalist in terms of, like, Schaefer had been here. Schaefer obviously decided he was going all in on that as a recruiting tool, which I think we were mostly fine with, yeah. / excited about when we had the whole Robert Washington saga. Seems like so long ago. It's really hard to know, just as there's been so much overhaul in that 5 years. Like, I think it really depends on what type of prospect we're recruiting, and I'd be interested to ask Babers about that as he gets more ingrained with the program. Like, if it seems like Babers is here to stay for a while, maybe that's when he starts to think about those longer-term traditions versus, like, he's probably still kind of feeling his way out in terms of being the Syracuse head coach now. Like, it's not like he knows everything there is to know about being the Syracuse guy.
I don't think he gives a shit about the tradition. I think that's fine. I think if Babers hits up Floyd and says, "Yo, Floyd, you want to talk to Jim and we can pull 44 out of the mothballs?" Like, I think Babers has been in so many places. I think he's never had the time to sit around and, like, attach himself to these traditions. And I feel like also most of the places he's been aren't, like, tradition-rich schools. I mean, Arizona, Baylor, us, Bowling Green. Like, these are not places that are, like, you know, gushing with tradition and hoopla. Like, he spent, what, a year or two at UCLA? And even then, like, they don't really have a ton of tradition outside the venue they play in. I think he's not someone who's overly attached to tradition. I think that might be to our benefit here in some ways.
Yeah, I think it helps in terms of he's not going to be persuaded by trying to run the program like Ben Schwartzwalder did or you know, Coach P did. I do wonder if, you know, with a guy like Wildhack in charge, who obviously is very much rooted in tradition, at least in terms of just being a, you know, before he was here, we all know Wildhack was, like, a big Syracuse fan who happened to work at ESPN at a high level. So he obviously knows what's going on. So I do wonder if, like, they start to come together. And I don't know that Babers, like, cares or you know, holds them super dear to his heart or anything. But who knows if, you know, he and Wildhack can kind of find a way to mesh these traditions with ways to improve the program. Kind of like what I think Schaefer was trying to do by taking 44 out of the rafters for Washington, who was, you know, obviously a huge recruit at the time.
Agreed. I think that's good for halftime. So, Dan, what have you been drinking?
Of a cocktail weekend down in South Carolina. I did have some Westbrook while I was there, as I yeah. am wont to do. A lot of white tie, some Doza. We flew in and out of Savannah, Georgia, where I'd never been. We went to one of the local breweries there, which was kind of near, like, their River Street, which is, like, their historic district. It was Moon something. Moon City, I think. Moon City, it was a brew pub, which was, like, right in the heart of, like, all the very touristy stuff, so I was a little questionable about going in. I only had one beer there because we were short on time. It was their Yoga Pants American Pale Ale. It was really delicious, honestly. It was quite good. Was better than my expectations, and everyone else, like a couple other people at high PAs, everyone seemed to enjoy them, so that was good. But yeah, a lot of the other just normal South Carolina beers I have when I'm down that way, a lot of Westbrook, which seems to really be exploding down there, which is fun, and I'll be back down in the North Carolinas next weekend, so more of that. Hopefully some foothills. I'll be up at my brother's graduation in Winston-Salem. So that should be fun, since brewery scene down there is pretty legit, as we all talk about pretty often.
Yeah, I actually, my parents thankfully grabbed me bottles of sexual chocolate and barrel-aged sexual chocolate that I now have in the fridge. I have not opened them yet. They are there.
Great.
Yeah, looking forward to trying those later this summer. Some things I had, White Noise, a wit beer from St. Arnold down in the Houston area. Had a No Name IPA from Artifacts Orange County Brewery. Had a Am I Right or Amarillo. It was a pale ale from Bell's. Had a King Harbor, which is over here, and I mentioned them a bunch. Their Coconut IPA. Had Beechwood. I talk about them all the time. They had their Citraholic, but then they had a Super Citrus. It's more hops, just very, very citrus loaded. Really fantastic beer. Had an Orderville from Modern Times. Orderville used to be a West Coast style IPA, then last year they turned it into an East Coast style IPA. I am very sad for the tradition that everyone is leaving behind for some reason around here, and that is making East Coast IPAs in the West Coast instead of the very good West Coast IPAs that we've made for many, many years. One very good West Coast IPA I've had a bunch lately is Tap Into the Power from Hop Saint, which is about a mile from me here in Redondo Beach. Very cool spot. They make good food. My wife doesn't like the food as much, but I do, so we definitely try to head over there every once in a while. And then I went to my first Dodgers game of the year and grabbed Budweiser because it's the only beer there under $12. Which is delightful because, yeah, who doesn't want to pay $17 for a blonde ale from Golden Road?
Ooh, a Pilsner.
Delicious.
Which I've heard is now the trendy craft beer. That's fine.
You know what, though? People are making, like, really good... Like, I feel like Threes make some really good pills. And there's a bunch of other spots that I feel like they're making, like, just crisper, better Pilsners and, like, doing a nice job of it. I don't know. I'm fine with it.
Yeah, I have no problem with drinking Pilsners. I feel like generally, for me at least, they're less complex and there's less like things they can do to give them interesting flavors and interesting dynamics versus like an IPA or just even a regular pale ale or a sour or some of the other more trendy types recently. But if people, you know, start to change up the Pilsner game, I mean, I'm all in. Like I will drink whatever super good Pilsner everyone starts talking about. So. I'm ready to be wowed by the onslaught of Pilsners that I guess we're going to see soon.
See, I almost think like that's the mark of like a really good brewer is like if you can do something, like if you can make a Pilsner really stand out, I feel like I have a lot of respect for you.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's one thing.
It's almost, I get like where people are kind of tired of like the whole like just soup up an IPA and make it as hoppy and just like throw us, you know, three different hop varietals in there. And I get why people would be tired of that. But yeah, if you can find some way to make a Pilsner stand out, I totally agree. Like go for it. And I will applaud you if it goes well.
Same here. I will have plenty, speaking of beer, to discuss next week. I'm going to the brewery 9th anniversary festival on Saturday down in Orange County. It seems like all the local players and some non-local folks brought their A game. Some that you might enjoy, Dan. They have a what's basically being described as an Almond Joy Black Tuesday. They have what else did I see? There's a Cookies and Cream Black Tuesday. There's a bunch of other stuff that's really going to be awesome. So I'm glad that we're looking at like 70 degrees, partial clouds. I don't have to deal with like just oppressive heat while I'm drinking these 15% and higher beers for 4 hours.
Speaking of. Of breweries, a good friend of mine, an occasional listener to the pod, just got a job running the tap room up at Wolf Hollow Brewing in the Capital Region up near like Schenectady. So, shout out to them. I have not had any of their beer, but I assume it is all wonderful.
I would too.
Hopefully, they can send some down.
Yeah, send some down, and we'll talk about it on the show.
I'll see if I can make that happen.
Perfect. Okay. So before we talked about five things that could happen in the future, now I want to talk about maybe five things that we thought would happen 5 years ago and see if they have now. Now, we didn't write this article 5 years ago, so this is going to be a little challenging, but Dan, I guess, what is one thing off the top of your head that you probably expected of this program in 2012, like before the 2012 season started?
So we're going right before Marone's final season.
Correct. When like things were a little shaky because it was like a 5-7 year, but we had a lot of seniors.
That's a super interesting one. I think we all had pretty cautiously optimistic because of the seniors, because we kind of showed that we had a high ceiling from the year before, and we, you know, obviously we had the really disappointing finish, but there was also a lot of, like, you know, Merlin probably wasn't on the hot seat, but there were, like, some serious questions about whether he was the guy long term.
Right.
Obviously losing, sits in a row in the year put some really bad taste in people's mouths, and rightfully so. That was definitely an interesting spot, because, like, you fast forward 4 months and everything's hunky-dory, and then Marone leaves and it's, you know, everything's up in the air. But before that season, it was definitely a pretty tenuous situation. It wasn't like I wouldn't say he was on the hot seat or anything, but there were some serious questions over the direction of the program.
Yeah. I thought he was going to work out to a point, and I thought that him and Gross were close enough, and that Gross was bad enough at his job, that, like, he wouldn't have been able to find somebody better anyway. So I thought then that Marone was probably there for the long haul, and I thought if we win 7-8 games this year, I felt that, like, that Marone would just be there, they'd be the guy. Because I think a lot of us, you know, we bought into the dream job stuff. We also just bought into the fact that he was an alum who wanted to come back and return the program to greatness. I guess what we didn't factor in was he only wanted to return the program to greatness. He didn't really have any interest in keeping them there.
Yeah, and it also would have been interesting if he had a more standard, or if he had only won, like, 7-6 or something. Like, I think the fact that he turned that team around so well and they ended on such a hot streak, that made him a more attractive candidate, where if they had just had, you know, let's say they had drawn 6-6 and won a low-level bowl game.
So, like, if the 2013 season had happened in 2012.
Yeah, if you flopped those two, like, then you have some interest. Then he probably would have left after the following season, assuming the Bills aren't the only team that was interested in him. But it definitely raises some interesting questions.
Yeah, I think the Doug Marone what if, like, rabbit hole is a whole nother thing that you could probably do an entire podcast about. I'd say 5 years ago, I thought that something was going to be done about the dome or the stadium situation by now. Which, again, that kind of worries me about the 5 years into the future thing about the dome. Like, I feel like 5 years ago we were pretty certain something was going to happen. It's just weird that something hasn't. I don't think we were expecting to be back at kind of square one. I mean, we're not now, but, like, last year we were. I don't think we expected to be back at the bottom where we were before Marone arrived already. I think we at least thought we'd be able to maintain some sort of every other year bowl situation by now, which obviously hasn't happened yet.
It's the dome situation. It feels like the dome has been, like, on the block since I got to Syracuse. So that's one of the things that makes me, like, a little worried about that 2024 mark. I still think that we're going to get there, just because it seems like there are more solid things being put in place. But even since, like, I feel like it's been, what, how many years has it been since the plans leak? Two?
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like we've made a lot of progression there since then. You can argue we've actually had, like, some
negative progression.
So, yeah, I mean, that's just one of the dome is just such a complex issue, and I get why it's tricky, because it's expensive, obviously. It's a private school. There are debates whether or not you should get or want public money for it. And then there's just, like, the question of just where do you put it? And, like, there are huge pros and cons to where the dome is now. There are huge pros and cons to, like, the three or four other sites that are always mentioned. So I get why it's such a tough issue to sort out, but it's not like those variables are changing, really. Like, they're kind of just the variables they're going to be unless you have some drastic, you know, other things swoop in. But, like, I don't know. I am surprised that we haven't had a little more progression on it. And I feel like when I got to Syracuse, we were having largely the same conversations with maybe, you know, we had seen fewer renderings of stuff at that point, but renderings haven't seemed to materialize into more.
Yeah, and honestly, at this point, like, I think we were maybe naive about how much or little money Syracuse had on hand at the time. I think now we are a little more flush with cash. There's also more demands on our resources, but SU does have a little more money to play with now. So I think that, yeah, I think there's no excuse at this point 5 years from now. There's arguably a few more excuses from 5 years ago than we might have realized at the time.
It also doesn't help that you've had, you know, multiple changes at the top of the athletic department. So it's not like John Wildhat's been here and just hasn't gotten off of, like, you know, wherever he's been. We also had a change of chancellor. So all those things kind of cause, like, stop and starts. Right. So not to excuse them, because, like, for a long time it was Gross and Cantor, and they were here for a decade. So
I think more. Campus, but not enough with the athletic department.
Right. So I think that the current administration, and I do assume Wildhack, like, I don't think Wildhack would have left ESPN to go make Syracuse a stepping stone AD job. Like, that just doesn't make any sense, yeah. Even when you see what happened with, like, Marone. Like, Marone, the step forward from Syracuse is an NFL job, and he took it. Like, there isn't really a step forward from Wildhack unless he just wants to go back to ESPN, which, in light of recent events, I don't think is a thing, so... and he probably would have been one of the heir apparents to Skipper if he had just stayed. So clearly he wants to run the Syracuse athletic department. So he should be here for a while if he does a decent job. So hopefully, I think they deserve, he and Siverud deserve a little more leniency with this. But I get the frustration, and I share in it, because it does seem like we're just treading water with the dome stuff.
Yeah, and I believe, who was it in that Carlson article today? Was it Evan Foster? Who was talking about the locker room?
I didn't read it, but the locker room is, at least last time I was there, and I don't think they've renovated them, the locker rooms are bad. Like, they are really, the dome locker rooms, I assume the football practice facility ones are nice, the dome locker rooms are rough. They are not what you expect a D1, an FBS Power 5 football program to have in their on-campus stadium.
And everyone saw them right on television last year. When, yeah. Baber's speech was going.
They're embarrassing, to be honest. I've been in them. I remember being shocked because my high school, which was a public high school in Connecticut, not exactly Texas, had nicer lockers than Syracuse. Yeah. And, you know, they were wooden and customized for seniors, and they, you know, they weren't probably the best high school football locker rooms in the state of Connecticut either. So, that is definitely a thing that you can do for, you know, it'll cost some money, but not that much money in the grand scheme of things. And that's, like, a direct thing you can do to help recruiting. Like, you bring your recruits in there. And if I'm Babers, like, I want to avoid bringing my recruits in the dome locker room. And then if you do that, like, you have to answer the awkward question of, hey, why don't we get to see the lockers? Like, it's not a good situation.
I would agree. And, yeah, the fact that that Evan Foster was willing to talk about it, seemingly almost unprompted, with Chris Carlson, probably is all you need to know about that issue, and something that hopefully is addressed soon. I think Carlson had a lot of good stuff in that article. One thing was the fact that Wildhack seems to be, he's not moving heaven and earth necessarily, but he is ready to do whatever Babers expresses as, like, something that needs to get done. I mean, you look at the personnel changes, additional coaching hires. It's going to be very interesting to see what they do when, I believe it's next year in January, or is it after signing day, that the 10th staff position is added?
I'm not sure on the timing, but it is that, I mean, I think that when you compare, like, what Syracuse has staff-wise to, like, I mean, it's stupid to compare anyone to Alabama, which is, they're, like, hilarious with how many people they add to their staff, but it will be interesting to see what the, I know most people thought it would just be, like, another... It would be mostly used to promote someone from within for most staffs, but it'll be interesting to see if a school like Syracuse, which could use, like, some extra advantages here and there, will try to do something more with it.
I hope they do, to be honest, because you look at, I mean, it's not to put down anybody on the staff right now. I just don't see anyone who's, like, ready to jump in, who's just in a quality control role or a grad assistant role. Like, I don't see anybody that has that experience necessarily to just jump in.
Right. From what we know, like, it's, you know, you can only know so much about the sports staff because they're not, you know, you can't just say, oh, the defensive quality control specialist is why the defensive ends are struggling. Like, that doesn't make any sense. But there's no one that just jumps out at you as someone who, like, is an obvious name or whatever.
I would have said if Lustig hadn't gotten hired that this would have been a perfect opportunity to bring back Steve Gregory.
Yes, I know he's one of your favorites in recent years. We also had some progression while he was here. So.
Exactly. Like, that's the thing. Like, Gregory, I talked about Gregory when he first came in because he had the opportunity to change things, and he actually did. Lustig has the chance to change things too. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing what he does. It seems like he's more special teams focused and running backs focused. So I just hope that the running backs can't take more of a step back from last year. So I would think that potentially, whoever comes in as that 10th guy ends up being a running back-specific coach, and that Lustig then moves directly into just the special teams kind of area.
Yeah, and it helps that Babers is a running back. I mean, he's a running back's guy. So hopefully that'll help pick up the slack in the meantime.
Yeah, I mean, Babers is so secretive. I'd be very curious to see, like, kind of how he runs his program. I feel like Boeheim has always been very open and honest about how he runs his program. I feel like Schaefer was pretty realistic about how he ran his program, and a lot of other SU football coaches have been. Babers, I feel like we probably know the least about him through 1 year and change than we have any other recent coach. Is that a bad thing? Just pointing out, like, we don't really know a ton about, like, what the day-to-day practice stuff is and how much time he spends with different position groups, stuff like that, versus the assistants.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's because Marone, like, while Marone eventually locked down pretty tight, there was a good, like, year or two, like, where I was doing spring practice every day, and I got to watch a lot. Like, there was, like, a year and a half where Marone was pretty open while he was still trying to win people over, and then he locked down shop. And then Schaefer had been on campus for so many years that you kind of knew what he was all about. And his personality and whatnot, mostly from watching Marone practices, where Schaefer was among the more fun people to focus on because he was so energetic and so hands-on. Where Babers, like, he's just been kind of closed down shop from day one. Obviously, those of us who write about the team or write about teams in general would rather have more openness, but, you know, I don't necessarily blame him for it. It's not like he's the only football coach that's that way. So,
especially on the spread end of the spectrum.
Yeah, especially coming from the tree he comes from on a straight football level, not to bring up other stuff, obviously. But on the, like, just pure football, they are very much not about, like, opening up about their trade secrets. So he's definitely one of the more mysterious guys. That's why I was surprised, you know, a month or two ago when Richard Johnson wrote that piece, how much he was able to get. Like, that was one of the more lightning things we've gotten from Babers, and it was surprising to see him give that to anyone. You know, obviously Richard's more of a national guy, but either way, like, it wouldn't, if it was Carlson or Bailey, same thing. Like, I was surprised that he was that revealing about, and he still, like, it wasn't like we found out a ton of the day-to-day ops. Yeah.
We didn't get the map on the back of the Declaration of Independence.
No.
All we got was a little bit more honesty about a few little things here and there. We actually got the real story on the Dino thing that, like, was completely different from the original Dino story. And either way, it's fine. I'm just pointing out the weird kind of divergence in origin stories we've gotten now. Alas.
I do like that we have a church with an origin story.
We do. And that makes him a superhero in more ways than one. I did think it was strange. Like, I'm not complaining about it at all. I know you're not either. It was interesting to see, like, how little he's given everybody else until that interview. Like, of all the interviews, like, I mean, obviously, like, we're part of SB Nation, but, like, to give SB Nation, and, like, Richard's a younger guy, like, to give him all that info was interesting. versus, like, again, a lot of the other, like, he talks to Hale on a regular basis. Like, he talks to a lot of other guys who've been around a little bit longer. Like, that's probably a testament to how good Richard is as an interviewer.
Yeah, because it wasn't, like, a guy who he had... Like, Hale wouldn't have been surprising. And obviously, Carlson or Bailey are one of those guys. Obviously, some coaches, like Boeheim, is one of these guys who tends to give a little more to the national people, for better or worse. But, like, if he had gone to David Hale with that same piece or that, you know, same level of openness, it wouldn't have been a surprising. Where Richard, like, I don't think he hadn't had much contact with Syracuse at all before that. So, definitely an interesting one. Obviously, we talked about that a lot when it came out. But, it'll be interesting to see how much more open we get from Babers. And a lot of that will have to do with success. Like, if he, has a great season, maybe he's willing to shed a little more light. Obviously, I don't think it'll be on whatever the Nets' moves are strategically, but just in terms of how he runs things. I think we all appreciate when we get a little more personality from our coaches, and he seems to have a very good one, even if he is more buttoned down than, you know, some other guys, although college football coaches across the board are just so tight-lipped and so unwilling to give themselves, for the most part, that it's hard to really blame him or be surprised by it or anything.
Well, that's the thing with college coaches, too, is that then you get, like, if you are super open, then you're labeled, like, a weirdo. Like, you look at like, Pirate Leach. I'd say, like, Jim Levitt until the stuff happened with the potential abuse. I'd say, like, you know, Les, a couple others. Like, yeah, you're just kind of, like, labeled a weirdo if you're, like, super open.
Who are the weirdo college football coaches? Can we, like, run them down? Because Leach is obviously, like, one.
Leach is one and two.
Harbaugh is definitely...
Harbaugh's a different type of weirdo, though. Harbaugh is, like, a homicidal lunatic. He's not like Leach, where Leach is just, like, this, like, wacky guy who just happens to be a college football coach. Like, Harbaugh
is... It also Harbaugh's seems all very strategic.
Oh, it like, is.
It's very, very painted, and I appreciate a lot of it, but it you could kind of tell where he's looking. Like, Leach, I don't think Leach is... Leach going on a rant about like pirates in Tunisia is really offering any kind of strategic any help for Washington State football. Where Harbaugh is just weird, but like everything he does, you can kind of see where he's angling to help Michigan.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a well done one because it comes off as authentic, and it might be authentic, but it is everything has a purpose.
Yeah. I think
Gundy is kind of a weirdo.
Gundy is a weirdo, but he's like a football weirdo.
Yeah.
Like he's a football weirdo. I'd say who was I thinking of? What's his name? Oh, Sonny Dykes. Seems like he's a little bit he might be another football weirdo, but he's like I feel like Texas football weirdo is like its own like category here.
Texas football is always its own thing.
Yeah. Ooh,
Holgerson.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say Holgo is definitely but he's another. He's like he is like a Red Bull fueled machine. Rather than just a weirdo, he's just a strange guy.
Yeah.
Narduzzi seems like a really weird guy based on that goddamn Kiwi story.
But he's such a football person. Like he's such a football guy.
He is.
I'm
trying to think. I'm racking my mind for like all the guys out here. Because there's got to be.
Oh, Mike Riley is a weirdo just because he doesn't fit in with football coaches. Like,
no.
He's like the least football coach.
I buy that.
And it's kind of weird that he's at Nebraska now, where that's such a middle of the country, like literally and figuratively, like grass fed football program, and he is still such the West Coast guy.
See, I don't buy Kingsbury as a football coach guy.
No, he seems very, especially like he seems very laid back.
He's saving up for his career in broadcasting.
That's possible. He needs to be like a little more successful for it to be like super lucrative, but he'll probably get it either way. Like,
I mean, if you look like Cliff Kingsbury, things just kind of come to you, Dan.
It's true.
you can just kind of fall into whatever you want.
Let's see.
Like other like what I'm trying to think West Coast in particular. Not a lot, like, to be honest, like, there's been enough turnover over here, and I feel like they actually, like, put a bunch of, I mean, that's why the Pac-12 is so good now, is they actually, like, implemented, like, all these football-centric guys other than Leach.
Yeah, it's, there's just different levels to them. Obviously, like, Carroll was his own thing. Trey Helton is, like, Carroll very light.
Like, yeah, I mean, where, like, Carroll's in this category, though. Carroll, like that's the thing. It's like, Carroll less, like, these are guys that we're looking for, and there just aren't a ton of them anymore.
Yeah, people seem very, I don't know, the whole, like, football coaches are so much, like, their own thing that it's tough, like, I can almost get why you wouldn't want to be branded different than that, which is why Harbaugh can, you know, while it's so you could almost even argue it's forced, like, I appreciate that someone is trying to act differently, especially when, like, Harbaugh is still, like, the most football focused person in the world.
Oh.
But he allows himself to be a little different, just to differentiate himself from, like, the massive other Big Ten coaches out there.
Maybe, like, Orgeron, maybe. Would be, like, a fringe guy in this category of, like you're a weirdo, but you're more just, like, a Bayou guy?
He's a Bayou guy. He's, like, kind of happy to be there.
Yeah.
He definitely has his own personality.
Houston, that's a weirdo, but he's another guy who's, like, not currently...
He also hasn't had a job in... Yeah. He's had a job in, like, 8 years.
PJ's a weirdo, but, like, in a Holga way.
Yes.
Like, you're just also by Red Bull.
Yeah, and also he's, like, everything's very, like, focused. Like, right. Like he's a reason for everything. Plan. Like, Leach is just so special because there's no one like Leach.
Right.
There are other guys who have, like, slight tendencies. Leach is the only coach like Leach out there. Like, Leach is closer to Bill Walton than anyone else that we have in sports.
I buy that. Yeah, I think
that's why he needs to be preserved and needs to keep a job forever. Unless he actually starts, like, locking players in sheds, and then maybe not. But for now, he needs to keep that job forever.
To be honest, if he goes 6-6 in perpetuity at Wazoo, I feel like he just stays there.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, Wazoo, you cannot gamble on you guys getting better than that. Like, 6-6 average with the occasional... I mean, he's had, what, back-to-back 9-win years? Like, that's great. That has bought him a lot. And he's, like, one of the only guys who, like, maybe he takes a bigger job if someone comes knocking, but it doesn't seem like people are, banging down the door to get Mike Leach. And he seems like a guy that...
In his late 50s, at least, if not in his 60s at this point.
He's older, he has a little bit of baggage, and, like, he also seems like a guy who, like, if the best he's going to do running out the stretch here is just hanging out in Pullman, like, he seems like he'd probably be kind of happy with that. Like, maybe if someone came calling, he would go, but it would probably have to be the right situation, and I don't think he's, like, desperate to leave Wazoo, because Wazoo's given him a lot of freedom.
I'd agree with that. You know, he's also been an interesting guy. What's his name? Tony Sanchez over at...
he's very intriguing at UNLV.
And he's a guy who's going to just see his star rise at some point just because of, like, the amount of money that's probably headed UNLV's way.
They are an interesting program. I don't buy that they're going to be, like, a Pac-12 expansion contender anytime soon.
Academics aren't.
But I think just having a... If you can build a solid group of five team in Vegas... You have there's a very nice niche market there, and Tony Sanchez was obviously an inspired out of the box hire. He was right from the high school ranks, right? He was the Bishop Gorman head coach, if I remember correctly.
Yes,
that's a very pragmatic go for broke hire. It seems to be working because they took pretty big leaps in terms of, like, competitiveness from year one to year two with him. Obviously, they're not, like, competing with Boise State yet, but they were a lot better in year two. He has built-in connections at the only really big football factory in that state. So they're an interesting program for sure.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing the battle there over the next probably 5 years between San Diego State and them, as those two programs kind of fight it out for this, you know, like the non Pac-12 Southwest kids. And meanwhile, I actually think the Mountain West Mountain Division is one of the best in the group of five for sure, and probably one of the best six or seven divisions in college football right now.
Yeah, and they're in a decent spot because, like, if the Pac-12 expands, like, odds are they're not going to be gunning for, like, oh, let's just draft the two best Mountain West teams. Like,
right. They're going to go for Texas.
They're going to go for a Big 12, unless someone makes a huge move somewhere or, like, something weird happens, like BYU, which it seems more like... It doesn't seem like that's all that likely. So, the Mountain West is in pretty good shape as far as the group of five goes, because there isn't a lot of room, like, unless the Big 12 expands, and even so, like, the Big 12 is not going to be dying to add Mountain West teams. Like, they're in a very nice, like, homeostasis between being so good that you're going to lose teams, like, the AAC had, I guess the Big East really had, the AAC hasn't had, like, that problem. But they're way too good to, like, worry. I don't think the AAC is going to approach them. I don't know why you'd leave the Mountain West with the AAC, so.
I know why North Dakota State should probably just join the Mountain West. That'd be fun.
That would be fun.
North Dakota State, Little Gonzaga.
That'd be interesting.
Let's make this happen, guys. Anyway.
Gonzaga would be tough because of where they are, because there just aren't recruits there. Okay. But I guess there aren't in North Dakota City either. They just make it work.
They have to do. All right. I think this this conversation's probably gone on long enough. As fun as it is, Dan. So that was Dan. I'm John. Dan, thank you as always for joining. Much appreciated.
Of course. Thank you for listening, everyone.
Of course, the five of you that are still here. You've been listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk. There are still SU teams playing sports, so for the time being, go Orange.
Go Orange.